content of this program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. Hello, Michael Blakely here with Religion in the News. For the next 28-odd minutes, I'll be reading articles from various news services on the subject of religion. Today's program is sponsored by White Memorial Presbyterian Church, to whom thanks. They can be reached at 919-834-3424. From The Economist, first, of May 16th. Atheist churches, the elusive phenomenon of churches without God. When a group sings, talks, and bonds like a religion, but may not be one. One recent Sunday, about 40 people turned up at their regular gathering place, a community center in Seattle, and soon found themselves pondering an ethical dilemma. Would it ever be right to punch a Nazi? The discussion was led by a husband and wife team who pointed out that hurting people was usually a bad idea, but that it might sometimes be the only way to protect the innocent. In a world as imperfect as this one, sometimes the choice is between a number of terrible ideas, suggested the husband, Mickey Phoenix. Other recent topics for debate at the Seattle Atheist Church have included the difference between compassion and empathy, and whether or not reparations should be paid to the descendants of American slaves, as argued by the writer Ta-Nehisi Coates in a recent story for Atlantic Magazine. Once they've exhausted their discussion, participants can get to know each other over juice and snacks. Like many similar clubs across the Western world, this atheist church aims to offer some of the features of a religious congregation, fellowship, collective enjoyment, a stimulus to moral behavior, while eschewing any belief in a deity or the supernatural. Ruth Walter, the founder of the Seattle community, sums up its ethos by drawing a contrast with a Christian hymn, "God Moves in a Mysterious Way." At her church, she says, "We believe in good because good works in non-mysterious ways." In today's kaleidoscope of beliefs and practices, atheist churches have carved out a niche. It is one that needs definition. In almost all Western countries, including the relatively pious United States, the number of people who acknowledge no religious affiliation, known as religious nuns, N-O-N-E-S, is surging. But that is not necessarily the same as being an atheist. One survey by Pew Research showed that the proportion of Americans who call themselves unaffiliated jumped from 16% in 2007 to 23% in 2014, and that second figure includes 3% of the total population who call themselves atheists and 4% who identify as agnostic. Another pollster, the Public Religion Research Institute, PRRI, reports that among unaffiliated Americans, 22% believe in a personal God, 37% in an impersonal one, and 33% say they do not believe in God. On the other hand, plenty of people who do have a religious label are uncertain in their beliefs. PRRI finds that a quarter of Catholics sometimes doubt God's existence. So where do atheist churches belong on this spectrum? Obviously, they appeal to people whose worldviews reject the supernatural, but in their own way, they are, as they themselves say, doing what all religious communities do, but simply without gods and the supernatural. Take the instance of the North Texas Church of Free Thought, established in 1994 by a physician, Tim Gorski, in the generally devout area of Dallas-Fort Worth. Its attractions include Sunday school, where children go while parents attend services, but instead of Bible stories taught as fact, this Sunday school helps youngsters develop ways of understanding and thinking that will help them cope with classmates who come from more God-fearing homes. The church's website lays out its founder's passionate belief that science alone holds the key to objective reality, while religion speaks to subjective needs that everyone has. At their gatherings, members enjoy discussions of history, morals, personal and social problems, listen to music, and learn about inspiring scientific breakthroughs. Phil Zuckerman, professor of sociology and secular studies at Pitzer College in California, describes the phenomenon of atheist churches like this: a small subset of those people who have lost their faith in a supernatural being still want the community spirit and behavioral norms that go with religious experience. In recent years, the most widely publicized and globally dispersed atheist church has been the Sunday Assembly, launched in London in 2013 by Sanderson Jones, former salesman for The Economist, full disclosure, and Pippa Evans, who both had some experience as comic performers on stage. It now flourishes in 55 outposts across Britain, continental Europe, North America, and Australia, with a total of about 3,500 regular attendees. That is not quite the spectacular growth that initially looked possible, but the movement has morphed in interesting ways. Under the motto, Live Better, Help Often, Wonder More, it offers participants a chance to sing and laugh together, join in doing useful work, and contemplate reality in a spirit not of conventional devotion, but of awe. Lots of lessons have been learned, says Mr. Jones, especially about how one initiative can mesh constructively with others. The Assembly's branch in East London is used by a public housing association as a way of helping people whose problems, psychosomatic or psychological, might be eased by joining a community. In the Los Angeles branch, there is a director who says she is applying principles learned while helping Barack Obama's presidential campaign in 2012. Surveys of Assembly goers suggest that the great majority feel greater life satisfaction through participation. For some skeptical sorts, both the Dallas community and Mr. Jones's Assembly are too much like regular churches for their liking. But can these atheist churches be described as a form of religion? Ms. Walther, founder of the Seattle Gathering, responds with a definite yes to that question, but Mr. Zuckerman is more ambivalent. If you define religion as just belief in God or gods or supernatural beings, then it's not religious, he says. But if you define religion more broadly as having a belonging component and a behavior component, then it does fall under that umbrella. And from the Religion News Service now of May 18th, a murderer makes repentance in a new role as a prison imam. Nabil Haq remembers July 28, 2006 well, even if he doesn't want to. He packed two handguns, ammunition, and a combat knife into a laptop case and drove to McDonald's for what he thought would be his last meal, hotcakes, a cheese McMuffin, and a Coke. Then, filled with fury, Haq began his 3.5-hour drive to Seattle from central Washington to open fire on the Jewish Federation of Greater Seattle, where later that day he shot 6 women, leaving 1 dead and 5 seriously injured, including one who was 17 weeks pregnant. He was convicted of murder, attempted murder, and a hate crime. Now 11 years into his imprisonment, Haq is the new imam for the Airway Heights Correctional Main Facility in Airway Heights, Washington. In his role, he's trying to lead by example in conveying remorse to those he hurt. I have to make some right out of my terrible wrongs, Haq said via email after an in-person interview with Religion News Service. I have a deep regrets for killing and maiming innocent people. I will spend the rest of my life trying to rectify any misdeed as much as possible. Despite a no-contact order that prevents Haq from contacting his victims, he wrote 8 accountability letters to his victims last year. Over 37 pages, he apologized to individual victims and to the Jewish Federation of Greater Seattle. Victims can be notified when an inmate leaves a letter, according to the prison system's Victim Services Program. None of Haq's victims have asked to be notified, however, and none have asked to read the letters he's submitted. To really make amends, I have to be innovative, he said. For me, it's the right thing to do. Shooting victim Cheryl Stumbo declined to comment. Others either could not be located or did not respond. And the Jewish Federation of Greater Seattle did not respond to RNS queries. Forgiveness might not be forthcoming. Rabbi Joshua Stanton, founding co-editor of the Journal of Interreligious Studies and rabbi at East End Temple in Manhattan, said that when it comes to forgiveness, Judaism focuses on actions rather than words. The burden is on Mr. Haq to demonstrate a genuine and profound change, I mean, through his deeds in an ongoing way, Stanton said. Even when a perpetrator genuinely does change, the burden is not placed on victims or their families to forgive. Haq told his story recently in a 2-hour interview with RNS while prison guards stood watch and other inmates visited nearby with parents, girlfriends, and children. What he recalled was a troubled man's journey into hate-filled terrorism. When Haq opened fire on the Jewish Federation in 2006, it was at the height of the Lebanon War. He had grown up feeling isolated, he said, as his family was one of the few Muslim families in the Tri-Cities area of Kennewick, Pasco, and Richland. He said he only understood Jews in the context of a cultural rivalry. "I didn't understand that Jews were people too," he said. Perusing the internet one day, he learned that the Jewish Federation of Greater Seattle had sponsored a walk for Israel. "And I thought, women and children are being killed by the Israeli military in Lebanon and Palestine, and this group is sponsoring a walk for Israel," he said. Haq was eager to kill, and with mounting debt, a failed marriage, a collapsing career, and severe mental health issues, he was also eager to die. "I had completely failed at society," he said. "I had given society my best shot." On his way to Seattle that day, he pulled over and hiked down an embankment to practice shooting the .40 and .45 caliber handguns that he had loaded the night before. Then he reloaded his weapons and continued his journey, praying for forgiveness as he drove. And when he got there, the doors to the Jewish Federation were locked. He hit the buzzer, ducked out of sight from the surveillance camera, and with his .40 caliber Ruger in hand, he waited. Within minutes, a 13-year-old girl walked to the buzzer. Haq pointed the gun at her. "This is a holdup," he said. "Let me in." She obeyed. Haq made her lead him up the stairs to the Federation's newspaper office. He asked to see the manager, then began shooting. After the rampage and the trial, he was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole, plus 120 years. L. Gregory Jones, professor of theology and Christian ministry at Duke Divinity School, said it's common in most religions for someone to eventually become motivated to seek forgiveness and acknowledge their wrongdoings. "After enough time, the pangs of the conscience begin to work on someone to repent," he explained. "Most commonly, they seek forgiveness from those wronged and from their relatives. It's understandable that he would seek it. I think the yearning for reconciliation is a natural human desire." Haq said he wasn't truly ready to seek forgiveness until now because he had to, quote, unlearn the hate that he had had in his heart. He became the faculty's facilities imam in April when his fellow Muslim inmates agreed he was the most qualified. Among his peers, he had the most Arabic memorized, showed good character, and demonstrated remorse for his crimes. "I've interacted with Jewish prisoners, and I learned about their community," he said. "I now understand that my thinking was deeply flawed. I no longer feel the desperation and hopelessness that I felt, which led to my crime. I'm no longer the same ignorant man I was 11 years ago." He spent the first 6 years behind bars sleeping his life away, he said, before a prison psychiatrist adjusted his medication and diagnosed him with a schizoaffective disorder, bipolar type. Since then, Haq has earned 35 prison educational certificates as well as a paralegal certificate. "After wasting so many years, I became a man in a hurry," he said. However, Jones said Haq's victims may not be ready to forgive. He noted the passage from C.S. Lewis's Letters to Malcolm, chiefly on prayer, which reads, "Last week while at prayer, I suddenly discovered, or felt as if I did, that I had really forgiven someone I'd been trying to forgive for over 30 years. "It took 30 years for someone, a good of a person as C.S. Lewis, to forgive," Jones said. "There's a timefulness that people need to reach that. But there shouldn't be pressure put on the victim to do it on anybody's timetable other than their own." However, Jones noted, if someone isn't working toward forgiveness, the anchor they hold can corrode their own soul. Haq is trying to make amends by writing to his friends and family about forgiveness, the beauty of other religions, and gun control. He's been delivering similar sermons to the prison's Muslim community and speaking at its Toastmasters Club. "I'm thankful that I still have much to offer the world," Haq said. "Even voices among the lowest among us can change people's hearts and minds." Haq knows he has a long road ahead of him and that he may never be forgiven for what he did, but he said that he won't stop trying. "In all my studies of mental health, self-improvement, and religion, I can say now with certainty that hate is the worst mental illness, and I had to lose my freedom to learn this." And now from the Associated Press of May 18th. Every Chilean Catholic bishop offered to resign Friday over a sex abuse cover-up scandal in the biggest shakeup ever in the Catholic Church's long-running abuse saga. The bishops announced at the end of an emergency summit with Pope Francis that all 31 active bishops and three retired ones in Rome had signed a document offering to resign and putting their fate in the hands of the Pope. Francis can accept the resignations one by one, reject them, or delay a decision. It marked the first known time in history that an entire national bishops' conference had offered to resign en masse over scandal and laid bare the devastation that the abuse crisis has caused the Catholic Church in Chile and beyond. Calls had mounted for the resignations after details emerged at the contents of a 2,300-page Vatican report into the Chilean scandal leaked early Friday. Francis had accused the bishops of destroying evidence of sex crimes, pressuring investigators to minimize abuse accusations, and showing, quote, grave negligence in protecting children from pedophile priests. In one of the most damning documents from the Vatican on the issue, Francis said the entire Chilean church hierarchy was collectively responsible for, quote, grave defects in handling cases and the resulting loss of credibility that the Catholic Church had suffered. No one can exempt himself and place the problem on the shoulders of the others, Francis wrote in the document, which was published by Chilean T13 television and confirmed as accurate Friday by the Vatican. In a statement in response, the Chilean bishops said the contents of the document were, quote, absolutely deplorable and showed an unacceptable abuse of power and conscience, as well as sexual abuse. They asked forgiveness from the victims, the Pope, all Catholics, and vowed to repair the damage. Francis summoned the entire bishops' conference to Rome after admitting that he had made grave errors in judgment in the case of Bishop Juan Barros, who is accused by victims of Chilean priest the Reverend Fernando Caradima of witnessing and ignoring their abuse. But the scandal grew beyond the Barros case after Francis received the report written by two Vatican sex crimes experts sent to Chile to get a handle on the scope of the problem. Their report hasn't been made public, but Francis cited its core findings in the footnotes of the document that he handed over to the bishops at the start of their summit this week. And those findings are damning. Francis said the investigation showed there were grave defects in the way abuse cases were handled, with superficial investigations or no investigations at all of allegations that contained serious and obvious evidence of crimes. The result, he said, created a scandal for those who denounce them and all those who know the alleged victims. In other cases, there was negligence in protecting children, a reference to many cases of sexual abuse that have risen in recent years within Chilean religious orders, including the Salesians, Franciscans, and the Marist Brothers community. Some of these religious order priests and brothers were expelled from their congregations because of immoral conduct, but had their cases, quote, minimized of the absolute gravity of their criminal acts, attributing them to mere weakness or moral lapses, Francis wrote. But these same people, quote, were then welcomed into other dioceses in an obviously imprudent way and given diocesan or parish jobs that gave them daily contact with children. Such behavior has been the hallmark of the clerical sex abuse crisis worldwide, with bishops and religious superiors shuttling abusers from parish to parish or diocese rather than reporting them to police or launching canonical investigations and removing them from ministry. Francis said he was also, quote, perplexed and ashamed by the report's evidence that there were pressures exercised on church officials tasked with investigating sex crimes, including the destruction of compromising documents on the part of those in charge of ecclesiastic archives. He said such behavior showed an absolute lack of respect for the canonical process and, worse, reprehensible practices that must be avoided in the future. He said the problem wasn't limited to a group of people, but can be traced to the training Chilean priests receive in seminary, blaming the profound fracture within the church on the seminaries themselves. The Vatican investigation, he said, contained grave accusations against some bishops and superiors who sent to those educational institutions priests suspected of active homosexuality. The harsh assessment of the quality of seminaries suggests that the possible next step might be a full-on Vatican investigation of Chilean schools of priestly training. Pope Benedict XVI ordered such an investigation into Irish seminaries after he convened the entire Irish Bishops' Conference for a similar dressing down in 2010 over their dismal handling of abuse cases. The problems inside the church community can't be solved just by dealing with individual cases and reducing them to the removal of people. Though this, and I say so clearly, has to be done, Francis wrote. But it's not enough. We have to go beyond that. It would be irresponsible on our part not to look deeply into the roots and the structures that allowed these concrete events to occur and perpetuate. For years, sex abuse victims had blasted the Chilean hierarchy for discrediting their claims, protecting abusers, and moving them around rather than reporting them to police, and then handing out light sentences when church sanctions were imposed. Based on Francis's footnotes, the Vatican investigation compiled by the Catholic Church's top abuse prosecutor, Archbishop Charles Sixluna, and his aide, Monsignor Jordi Bertemeu, gave full credibility to the victims. Francis, though, has also been implicated in the scandal, and in his document saying all Chilean bishops bore blame, he said, "and me first of all." Francis first drew scorn from victims, ordinary Chileans, and even members of his sex abuse advisory board by appointing Barros Bishop of Osorno, Chile, in 2015. The Associated Press reported earlier this year that Francis did so over the objections of other Chilean bishops who knew Barros' past was problematic and recommended that he and other Caridima-trained bishops resign or take a sabbatical. The AP subsequently learned that Francis had received a letter in 2015 from one of Caridima's most vocal accusers, Juan Carlos Cruz, detailing Barros' misdeeds. That letter undercut Francis's claim to have never heard from victims about Barros. Francis further enraged Chileans and drew sharp rebuke from his top abuse advisor when, during a January trip to Chile, he said the accusations against Barros were calumny, and he said he was certain that Barros was innocent. After receiving the Sicluna Bartimeu report, though, Francis did an about-face, blaming, quote, a lack of truthful and balanced information about the case for his missteps. Francis invited the three main whistleblowers to the Vatican hotel he calls home so that he could apologize in person. And back to The Economist now of May 18th. The Peace of Jerusalem. Followers of Jesus fail to agree about his homeland. Christians hold clashing views about the land they call holy. Hundreds of millions of followers of Jesus Christ are about to celebrate the annual feast of Pentecost, which celebrates an event in Jerusalem roughly 2,000 years ago, when it is believed that cultural and ethnic barriers were miraculously overcome. The festival, which falls on May 20th in this year's Western Christian calendar, and a week later in the Orthodox one, commemorates what many regard as the establishment of the Christian Church. A new kind of divine inspiration, including the ability to communicate with speakers of any language, is said to have come over the disciples who had gathered in the holy city for the Jewish festival of Shavuot, which falls 7 weeks after Passover. So, there is sad irony in the fact that people who cherish that sacred story seem more divided than ever, with some rejoicing in Jerusalem's rising earthly status and others expressing the very opposite view. The divisions are especially pronounced among Christians who live in or feel strongly attached to the land they call sacred. Roman Catholics have been invited by the administrator of the Latin Patriarchate, the area's highest Catholic authority, to mark the eve of Pentecost with a, quote, prayer vigil for peace in a well-known Jerusalem church, clearly referring to the killing of around 60 Palestinians during recent protests at the Gaza-Israel border. The Italian organizer of the vigil, Father Pier Battista Pizzaballa, said, "We must all condemn forms of violence, any cynical use of human lives in disproportionate violence. Again, we are forced by circumstance to plead and cry out for justice and peace." His statement contained obvious hints of rebuke to both Hamas, the organizer of the protests, and the Israeli authorities. The Patriarch's website also published an appeal from an association of Catholic clerics and monastics in the region that put things more bluntly. Having expressed, quote, great concern over the 60 deaths and injuries suffered by several thousand, it said, these casualties, or most of them, could have been avoided if non-lethal tools had been used by the Israeli forces. We call upon all parties involved to avoid the use of violence and to find ways to end the siege imposed on about 2 million Palestinians in Gaza as soon as possible. In the meantime, we witnessed on the same day the relocation of the American embassy. Any such unilateral move or decision about the Holy City of Jerusalem doesn't contribute to advancing the long-awaited peace between Israelis and Palestinians. All of those views are a world away from the staunchly pro-Israel sentiments of many evangelical Christians, two of whose most rambunctious leaders offered prayers at the ceremony marking the new American embassy. One was Pastor John Hagee, founder and chairman of a powerful group called Christians United for Israel. And the other was Robert Jeffress, pastor of a Dallas megachurch, who is notorious for his blunt predictions that followers of such creeds as Mormonism, Islam, Judaism, and Hinduism are likely to end up in hell. Mr. Hagee insisted afterwards that moving the American embassy would bring peace closer by forcing the Palestinians to accept Jerusalem as the Jewish state's capital. He said the violence in Gaza occurred simply because, quote, Palestinians led by terrorists sought to breach Israel's borders and harm Israeli citizens. Yet another example of Hamas and the Palestinian Authority finding an excuse to incite their people to violence. Of the two, Mr. Jeffress is the more contentious because of his track record of harsh words on the likely fate of people who espouse other faiths or forms of Christianity different from his own. The State Department insisted that the pastor's appearance reflected a personal choice by David Freeman, the American ambassador, and the department as a whole would certainly not agree with the preacher's controversial remarks about various religious groups. Whatever their feelings about metaphysical matters, Mr. Hagee and Mr. Jeffress are both unshakable in their support for America's new policy toward Israel. Still, asked by Fox News about his less-than-ecumenical views, Mr. Jeffers said some previous statements of his had been ripped from context, but nonetheless he stood by his position that, quote, historical Christianity for 2,000 years has taught that salvation is faith in Christ alone, and the fact that I and millions of evangelical Christians still believe that is not bigoted and not newsworthy. Mr. Friedman, meanwhile, defended his choice of two pastors because they represented a community very much in support of the shift to the American embassy, one that shares the same belief that Jewish people have, that Israel is a special place, that its existence is evidence of a covenant between God and the Jewish people. And that, it might be added, all of the above-named parties are very much in support of America's 45th president. Well, that's all the time we have now for Religion in the News. Thanks very much for listening. Sponsored again by White Memorial Presbyterian Church, who can be reached at 919-834-3424. This has been Michael Blakely. I'll talk to you later.